The founder is the only person that can see around two corners. They're pulling people along with them for the vision of what the future is going to look like. Most employees are trusting that the founder knows where they're going, but you need to give your team something that they can then align themselves with on what their role is in that vision. And so you can't be too pie in the sky. You can't micromanage. You have to live somewhere in here where everyone can say, this is what I'm doing to work on this company goal, to work on that vision that we're building. And the best founders know how to kind of traverse those different modes. And I view investors' job is to ask about the future, but also focusing on the present and hold the founders accountable.
Hey folks, welcome to another episode of Climb by VSC. I'm thrilled to have on Rishi Taparia, Twitter friend turned IRL friend, who's the founder and managing partner of Garuda Ventures. Garuda just announced the close of their first institutional fund of $31 million just at the end of last year. And they're focused on backing early stage founders and supporting them with advice, time, and capital. Rishi, we got a lot to dig into today, man, but I want to start by saying thank you so much for joining me on Climb.
Great to be here and great to finally meet in person. After so long on Twitter. It's the best when online friends become real life friends.
Well, that's the great thing about this podcast too, is sometimes somebody's like, hey man, let's grab lunch. And I'm like, skip lunch, come on the show.
Exactly.
We'll get to hang out and gab and we'll be doing what we'd be doing over lunch anyway. I'm thrilled to have you on for, I think, a host of reasons. One, both of our funds, you know, closed really, our final closes within the last year. Yep. Lots of learnings about fundraising in this environment, about the changing environment for founders. But let's start with your background a little bit. So you began your career in venture capital, banking, then venture capital, then spent 7 years as an operator at early stage and growing companies, and now you're back to venture. So what drew you back, and why was this the right time to launch an institutional fund?
Yeah, great question. So for me, I love working with founders. Yeah. And I realized that when I was on the venture side, first at Scale Venture Partners, learning from amazing investors like Rory O'Driscoll, Kate Mitchell, Stacey Bishop, Ben Fu, and then getting pulled over to Matrix Partners and going even earlier, working with guys like Dana Stalder, Josh Hanna, and seeing what it means to invest behind a deck and a dream, maybe some early product. I went the operator route because I wanted to understand what it meant to actually be in a company. I think investors generally see what the company is showing to the investors, and there's a veneer across all of the numbers and the metrics. You're not seeing how the sausage is made. And I wanted to build. And so joined Point as the first business hire, seventh employee, had a 5-year journey there. And that's when I realized I'm a glutton for punishment, probably, and just love that early ideating phase. You're a small group of people who's trying to figure out a big opportunity. There's no systems, no processes, no tools, no anything. And you have to justify why you exist in the world for everybody, your prospective hires, customers, the market, investors. And so that was just a whole bunch of fun. And so scaling that business up over 5 years, then leaving to go to Legion, or again, similar role on the business side of the house. In 2021, it was the middle of COVID, and I just had my second kid and trying to figure out what next. And at that point, knew I wanted to work with early stage companies, didn't want to join an early stage company necessarily. Interviewing over COVID, I'm a very much in-person guy and appreciate the energies connecting in the real world. And so then it was, you know, credit to my wife who said, hey, look, you love investing. You love helping founders. You do this in your spare time. Why not think about going back onto the investing side?
Yeah.
And so talked to a bunch of funds and then also looked at the idea of turning Garuda full time. Yeah. We started Garuda Ventures in 2018 as a nights and weekends passion project.
Right.
Raised just under $3 million.
And who's the we?
Myself and my co-founder, James Richards. We grew up together in Indonesia. And so we were both part-time on the fund. And we were investing $50K, $100K into founders at pre-seed and seed. And just offering the advice and empathy for the journey and the understandings and learning from our own experiences.
Right.
And the founder feedback was great. And LP feedback was great. And so 2021, okay, maybe it makes sense to take this full time. James was going to be staying part-time as he started his next company, Evergrow, which ended up being the first investment we made out of his new fund. And Arpan Punyani, who I've known for 10 years, was an early LP in the fund. He'd early employee at Okta and built that company up. Over 8 years, we'd been working together and talking about going full, going on something together. And so we said, okay, why don't we come together and take Garuda full time and launch our debut institutional fund?
Yeah.
And so it was a confluence of things that led to going full time on Garuda, but largely stemming from a desire to partner with founders at the earliest stages of their journey and do so at scale.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. Give me the back of the baseball card for a second. I mean, what's the check size? What's the, you know, kind of overall strategy, focus, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so B2B focus, broadly speaking, investing across four kind of core themes: intelligent applications, commerce infrastructure, the new perimeter, which is kind of security infra, and then climate 2.0.
Yeah.
Our check sizes will go kind of $500,000 up to $1 million, generally investing in pre-seed with some seed, so probably two-thirds pre-seed, one-third seed. Looking to get kind of 7 to 10% ownership at pre-seed, in particular seed, will be a smaller check as part of a larger round. And so maybe 3 to 5% at seed. We'll happily lead, co-lead, follow. You know, we're playing nice in the sandbox, as I think we need to at the early stages. And looking to build a portfolio between 25 and 30 companies out of this vehicle.
Yeah, okay, perfect. Makes a ton of sense. As somebody who had, you know, done venture in the before times, before COVID, before I think valuations growing, and you know, I didn't start my career too much later than I think when you were at Scale and Matrix. So it's been very cool to see the evolution of venture.
Sure.
What are things that you used to care about more at Scale and Matrix that matter less at Garuda? And then on the flip side, what's something that you really look for now in the founders you're evaluating that maybe you didn't put as much weighting on before?
Scale and Matrix were later stage, and are later stage firms than we look at even at Garuda. And so I think the things that I cared about then, you know, show me data, show me traction, show me revenue, show me customers. What does product utilization look like? Things of that sort. Even at Matrix, which was, you know, Series A.
Although back then, Series A's were $3 to $5 million.
$3 to $5 million at 15 pre. So don't get me wrong. It's like, that's not the name of the game today. But you're still looking for that traction. For us now, it's a team and an idea.
Yeah.
So things that we care about, you know, who are you? Why is this the thing you want to be working on? What's the unique insight that you have on this problem? How deeply have you felt the problem before? Things of that sort, because it's ultimately an investment behind a group of people that have an idea or a thesis, a perspective on the future that now they're evaluating and trying to build a company around. And so we care a lot about team. We then look at kind of product vision and where you want to go. And then we look at kind of market and market sizing just to make sure it's, you know, not too going to be too small. But even that, you know, markets get bigger over time too, as I've seen before. And so, yeah, it's team, product vision, and then market is what we focus on.
A couple of interesting things to, I think, pick on there. One is the market sizing getting bigger. You know, that sounds like somebody coming from an operator background and understands that, hey, you actually get to force the market in a direction. Are there a couple of things that you picked up over your time as an operator that you feel like help you evaluate these founders a little better? Are there questions that you ask now that you feel like maybe you didn't, you know, you weren't thinking about until you became an operator?
Yeah, absolutely. I like to ask about not where the company is going to be in 1 to 2 years, but where do you think the company is in 5 years?
Okay.
In 10 years? Just not that there's a right or wrong answer, but just to see, is there a view or a perspective on a longer time duration that the founders have thought about? And, you know, I learned this from back when I was at Matrix and I met the Canva founders for the first time. You know, I had the chance to meet Melanie and Cliff when they were raising their seed round back in 2012, got introduced through a friend of mine who said, you know, you grew up in Indonesia, you know where Australia is, you should meet this boyfriend, girlfriend building design software for the cloud. And I said, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you meet Melanie and Cliff, and even back then, just a sense of, there was a sense of inevitability of like, these people are going to do something amazing. And this is, you know, the migration of the cloud hadn't happened. You didn't have the proliferation of cloud products. It was the box versus Dropbox wars, on-prem shift, you know, in the cloud and so on. And the idea of design software in the cloud, which was a market that was largely dominated by Adobe product, a whole bunch of nothing, and then MS Paint and Microsoft Word template, like, okay, what's going to happen? And you meet them and you see where they want to go and what, you know, there's a slide in their original deck about what they're going to do in what order. And that level of thought and insight into where they're going and the roadmap that they had painted, you look now and it's like, check, 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 check. And that was so compelling. Yeah. And obviously they've done amazing things. And I think important because at least you have an idea of what the path forward may look like. You can be proven wrong or you take different turns, but that is what I look at and look for now much more than I probably used to.
Yeah.
Where it's, oh, this is a, you know, great team and they've got some good ideas and there's early signs of something. Now it's like, okay, actually, where do you want to go with this? Because, and this is a hard lesson to learn as an investor and a founder, that just time scales are so long.
Yeah.
You don't know if you're any good for a decade, decade plus.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as an investor, as a founder, are you willing to sign yourself up for this problem and solving this problem for 10, 12, 15 years?
How do you evaluate that? I guess the, beyond just here's the roadmap we're thinking about, right? Because I think sometimes, again, I've had experiences where the founders came in with one business and by Series A, they had stumbled onto a much bigger problem, right? And, you know, I'll give you an example. Frank from Revel, if you, you know, spend time in New York and in SF, you'll see them everywhere. That started as a moped company.
Yep.
And it was only when they started interfacing with urban infrastructure and looking at their own cost structures and kind of looked at the Amazon route, right? Take something that's a cost structure and turn it into a revenue model is when they said, okay, we can do fast charging. We can do ride share. I think Frank would be honest, and he's been on this show, that they stumbled into it.
Yeah.
So I sometimes wonder if like the deck that somebody comes in with at seed stage is telling me enough, is telling me more about the product or is it telling me more about their ambition? So I'm curious how, like how you evaluate the, they're committed to this for a decade.
I think it's telling me about them as opposed to the product or the problem statement, because it signifies a thoughtfulness and an intention. Again, can change, can shift, can move around. But I've thought about this, not about what I'm going to do as a founder for the next 12 to 18 months, but what I'm signing myself up for the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm.
And I think it's that level of time commitment that I look for as an investor.
Yeah.
Only because, and again, it all varies based on like, are you experimenting, idea amazing? Do you have the idea? Are you signed up to be a founder and want to do this? Only because I can invest in the person.
Yeah.
I invest in the company.
Yeah.
And so if the person decides, okay, this is not for me anymore, and you know, things happen, that's fine. But I can't go with them necessarily to the next thing. Obviously, if they're great and I want to, and I would like
you
to
might back them again.
I might back them again. But that's a different check.
Yes.
And so I really am trying to just understand again for the founders, what's your why?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing this? And have you thought about it from the corner cases? Have you thought about it from what could happen? What might happen? What are the trends that are behind you and so on? Because it, again, signals a level of thoughtfulness. Don't get me wrong. There are going to be plenty of companies that are going to be great that come together over a weekend hackathon and stumble into an interesting product idea that turn into a big company. Those are probably not for me.
Yeah.
And again, I think every investor is different. And so some of the things that I key off of.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. You know, I sometimes struggle with, I think there's a spectrum of founders. On one hand, you have the laser focus on solving a single problem.
Yep.
And ultimately the challenge with backing sometimes a founder like that is the ambition isn't that big, right? And,
sure.
And maybe it's a great $100-200 million business in its sort of final version. That's great for the founder. Yeah. That's great for the early employees. That sucks for us, right?
Yep.
Unless, again, you own really a lot of that business, and then the alignment isn't always there. On the flip side, you have the founder that has the big audacious vision. They're going to, you know, take over the world, and focus becomes a real challenge because the world is their oyster. They can solve all these problems. They can throw engineers at the problem, and you never really find product market fit for, yep. for any of the lines or features or whatever they're trying to do. How do you kind of strike that balance in the middle? And do you have to find a founder with focus, or have you ever been able to help a founder kind of like discover focus, right? Guide them to focus?
I think the latter.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, focus is always hard, even as an investor. You know, what are the areas that we want to be spending time in? Where are the categories, and how do we, you know, hone in and make the strike zone smaller, not bigger? But I think for founders, that's what I view an investor's job is to do, is first do no harm, but also then support. And one of the ways to support is by focusing in on, okay, what really matters
yeah.
right now. And so, you know, this gets, is the opposite side of the, okay, I've got a 10-year, 15-year plan, vision, well, this is what I want to do. Okay, great. Now the question is, what do we need to get done in the next 6 months? What do we need to get done in the next 12 months, in the next 18 months? Because you can't go from here to where you'll be in 3 years from now. It takes incremental steps. I work with a founder right now who's an amazing kind of visionary founder, got big ideas, ties great bows around them. But the struggle for him sometimes is just on the execution side. Mm. How do you now turn that into a product, into a roadmap, and like go build towards it, get feedback from the market? And so what I try and do is bring him back to center and, okay, what do we need to execute now? Because you need to guide teams that way.
Yeah.
You need to express, the founder is the only person or the only people that can see around two corners. They're pulling people along with them for the vision of what the future is going to look like.
Yeah.
Most employees are trusting that the founder knows where they're going, but you need to give your team something that they can then align themselves with on what their role is in that vision.
Yeah.
And so you can't be too pie in the sky. You can't micromanage. You have to live somewhere in here where it's everyone can say, this is what I'm doing to work on this company goal, to work on that vision that we're building.
Yeah.
And the best founders know how to kind of traverse those different modes. And I view investors' job is to ask about the future, but also focus in on the present and hold the founders accountable mm-hmm. to that. You said by this date, you'd get this product rolled out. Where are we at? You said by this quarter, you'd be at this revenue. Where are we at? And constantly, again, realign on what the goals and objectives are for the near term, because plans change yeah. and the market turns, markets change. And so it's that constant balance. So, you know, for better or worse for our founders, I take copious notes and I will call back two meetings from now. Hey, a month ago, you said this and these guys, how are those going?
Yeah.
And they're, oh yeah, we forgot to mention. It's like, okay, well, let's like make sure we're talking about that and bringing it back up, because you got to do what you say you're going
to
do.
I think it's good to establish that expectation early on with founders too. You know, sometimes the word founder friendly, term founder friendly gets thrown around a sure. lot. Our mutual friend Nate Williams had a lot of thoughts on that term. And I tend to believe founder friendly isn't that you just hand them money and let them go do whatever they're doing.
Correct.
You know, I heard Shishir Marother from Coda actually had a really great kind of thing. He's like, I look at my investors as highly engaged, almost as a VP in my business,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
And my VPs are focused internally, and these investors are my VPs that are focused externally.
Yeah.
And they're going out in the market, they're evangelizing for me, they're learning things that they can come back and share with me. But my expectation of them is that they behave like a team member.
Of course. I agree.
Harder to do when you're, you know, managing a large portfolio with a lot of people. You can't be a VP at 18 companies at the same time. I guess from your perspective, you know, we talked about advice, time, and capital is kind of what Garuda is bringing these founders. How do you make sure that you're able to kind of tailor it and be bespoke to every founder, but at the same time still scale the service that you're bringing these folks?
Yeah. It starts with context. You need to have context for the businesses and kind of where the founders are at. And so, you know, we try to establish a cadence with our founders. You know, when you onboard as a Garuda portfolio founder, you're going to get a weekly meeting for the first 4 weeks, just to, again, get into the rhythm of what we're all about. Let's start building the trust. Let's start sharing information and talking. We have a bunch of then templates that we send to you to help you with your, you know, monthly investor updates, with your financials, with all these things, just again to level set and get you to a certain
like
level
a
of quality baseline.
Yeah.
And then it really depends on what the founders need from us. As I've learned being a parent of two young kids, like they both came from the same place, need very different things from me. And so founders are similar in that like not all founders need the same things. And so we don't have kind of a standard model of support. We understand the context and we view our job as to, okay, focus, bring some information from the outside and not just utilize our own kind of understanding of the problem, but also connect to our advisors, our community, broadly speaking, make the relevant introductions to the founders to help them on their journey. We view our role, help you go further faster as a member of your team. And so let us do that. But the only way we can do that is if we have the relevant information and we're trading notes. And so all of our founders know they can text us anytime. We're going to be there. We have a text thread with all of our portfolio companies. We have a group Slack with all of the founders in the Slack. We have regular check-ins. And then if you need something, you just call and we'll be there to answer.
Yeah.
But admittedly, as an emerging fund, we're kind of figuring out again, how do we get the community together more often? How do we share more information across the portfolio and bring more to bear in an effort to one-to-many scale? The other thing that I think is a learning that we've kind of picked up on that is, you know, intuitive in hindsight is, depending where you are in your founder journey, you're probably facing similar things. Everyone's going to have to onboard their first employee. For example, everyone's going to have to transition from founder-led sales to hiring a sales team. All of these are consistent. And so we're doing a bunch of work right now just to build our resource library, our content, our approach, and our thoughts to just give the answer,
like, or like playbooks.
At least the guide, the playbook. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because so often, and having been on the other side, I know I don't want you to like pontificate with me. Just give me the answer. Tell me what to do so I don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to come up with a lot of those to, you know, in a couple pages, here's how you do tax filings as an example, your 409A evaluation and how do you figure it out in the appropriate manner and make sure it's appropriate for your business. Things of that sort that every company is going to need, again, in an effort to scale one to many, since you don't need to have 30 phone calls about
it's
that
kind of
same
fascinating
topic.
To me that somebody hasn't productized that, but this is like a side tangent, but everything you're saying to me, I'm like, yeah, we, you know, one of the things, again, our focus is a little bit different around storytelling and content and, you know, helping build like a PR go-to-market muscle. There is probably a 90-day onboarding that we can do with every single company that we do. And I sit there going like, well, should we be doing that? Or should there be somebody externally who's built a product to actually go do that? The stuff that you're talking about is, I mean, even more broad, right? The 409A evaluations or onboarding or, you know, going from founder-led to sales, VP of sales-led. It kind of blows my mind that like this isn't just a common playbook.
Well, and it's the funny thing is because there's all of the content exists out there.
Yeah.
Somebody somewhere has written
Lemkin
all
at Sasser has done most
Lemkin
of this.
Lemkin has done this. First Round has done this. Andreessen has done this. You know, you think about YC has done this, right? But I also think it's about the curation and the synthesis, because I could send you five links and like go read this like, well, okay, what am I supposed to take away? Or I can say, hey, this is what we think. These are the things that support that. But you know, this is where we believe you should be at.
Yeah.
And I think those two things combine, you know, curation, synthesis, that's going to become more and more important as part of the venture job, I think, going forward than maybe it has been before. Because unlike, you know, 10, 15 years ago when we first got into this business, there's so much more out there and so many more founders out there that are seeing all of the advice from everywhere, including X or Twitter, and taking it all at equal value.
Yes.
Which it's not.
Yeah.
And so you almost have to help founders unlearn lessons as well, because what people share online and the realities are very different.
Yeah, and there's confirmation bias, right? Our algorithms feed into the stuff that we like.
That's right.
And so over time, you just start, you know, if there's a tweet out there that says, you should never hire a VP of sales, be founder-led sales until you're Series C.
That's right.
And you'll screenshot that and send it to your VC, be like, see, I don't have to hire that
guy. That's right.
And ultimately, I think it helps to kind of rein it back in and say, look, we have seen this approach work. And this is what I tell founders too. Again, we're a smaller check, right? We don't lead. But I tell founders, you know, the benefit that we have is that we are meeting hundreds of companies yes. every month, and we are seeing what folks are saying and maybe how it aligns with, you know, again, maybe not direct competition, but how it aligns with your viewpoint on the yeah. market. You're serving the construction industry. They're serving the construction industry. They have a very different thesis
That's
on
right.
how the buyer buys.
Yep.
Does that comport with what you're seeing in the
yep.
market? And maybe helps you think a little bit about a different buyer persona, think a little bit about how your go-to-market should be different. I tend to find that the best founders view it as that relationship, right?
100%.
Go out there, find me information. Let me focus on what I'm doing. But then when we check in once a month or whenever it is, you're yeah. kind of filling my cup with new information.
No, that's right. Yeah. We are in the market far more than the founder is or should be.
Should be, yeah.
And so we have to bring that level of insight, information, understanding, context. If you're asking me for product feedback, I'll give you product feedback as a prospective user to what I think, but I don't know
yeah.
your customer as well as you do. But I can certainly offer perspective on strategy, on pricing, on go-to-market motion, what's worked, because those are the things that are not unique to your business, but in fact, constants across any business. And that's where we have the insight and the understanding.
Yeah. Is there a hire that you think early stage founders make too late? And how do you advise your founders to maybe seek that person out sooner?
It depends. I think I have found a lot of benefit for founders in like that business athlete type of persona. Totally biased because that's what I was at two companies. And so I'm throwing that out there. But I think that, you know, somebody to come in and help offload from the CEO all of the things that are not unique that they need to be doing, you know, like the 409A, running the financial model, things of that sort, but that they could also help around the marketing, the PR, the sales.
And that's different from a chief of staff or a COO.
And so call it whatever, like that's where it gets a little fuzzy because, yeah. you know, is this a COO at a company? Is this a chief of staff to the CEO? I was the VP of business operations at one company and then this chief strategy officer at another company. Like, you call it what you will. But I think that thought partner who has that business lens and can stretch across a variety of things has proven to me across the companies that I've helped kind of and seen and interviewed for and they've hired has helped lighten the cognitive load for the founders to, again, help them focus.
Okay.
Because as a founding team, you need to figure out your product, you need to figure out product market fit, your customers, that's what matters. Spending a whole bunch of time closing your books does not matter. Spending a whole bunch of time figuring out the 409A does not, like, you have to get it done, but it shouldn't occupy as much brain space for you as it does.
Yeah.
And so how can you offload that into a young, hungry person that can grow with you and your business? That's a role I'd probably say, hey, hire a little bit earlier for than I've seen people do.
And what are the traits if I'm a CEO and you're advising me on, Jay, look, you're wasting too much time on the things that don't matter. You know, focus time with your customers, focus time with your team. What are the traits I should look for in this individual? If I'm trying to hire Rishi, what do I look for?
An aptitude, a desire to be kind of in startup ecosystem.
Okay.
Either they're in it already or they've been around it. I was on the venture side. You've got a lot of consultants. You've got a lot of, you know, MBAs that are now looking to get into startup. That's a great persona. And I think, you know, a background in consulting, banking, I call my banking days, it built my STQ, my shit-taking quotient is just really, really high as a result of banking. And so like high STQ, willing to put in the time, willing to put in the work, we'll get there first and leave last. Like that was always my mantra. And you can just like throw things at, and over time you build the trust where it's like, yep, they're taking it on.
Yeah.
At point, as an example, I think for the first 3.5-4 years, I was the only person allowed to talk to media outside of our CEO. As an example of like, and I was a 27-year-old, but you have a level of trust in the organization and an understanding of what's going on across the business where now you can speak intelligently and coherently to third parties. And so I would help on the media side. I would help on the fundraising, ran our fundraising processes across our A through our C, and you know, things of that sort.
That's huge, by the way. I'll tell a lot of founders that when you're going out and fundraising, your job is to go meet VCs, sell the story, sell the vision. Somebody should be manning the CRM.
Yes.
Somebody should be manning 100%. The DDQ, you know, yeah. the diligence questions that come in.
Absolutely.
And answering those and firing those back and forth. If you as a CEO are doing that as well as the pitching, I wonder how much time you have to continue growth in your business, right?
Yeah.
And that's it's a really tough balancing act when you're in fundraising.
No, fundraising, I think fundraising is a full-time job, especially in a market like today.
Yeah.
And so you will take a hit in your business for sure.
Yeah.
Because you're either not going to prioritize it or you're going to, I'm going to do this meeting and I'm going to go back to the product, which you love. And like, that's a safe space and fine. It needs to be prioritized, and having someone like this person is helpful because in an ideal world, you're prepping for the day's meetings. Here's who we're talking to. Here's their portfolio. Here's what I think we need to dig on with them. Here are some of the questions that we got from the last meeting that maybe we talk about upfront. And so we're not getting the question. We're proactively answering the concern that people like. It's a constant iteration. It's like, you know, it's, I think fundraising is like, you know, doing a comedy skit. You're working the various back rooms and bars and whatnot before you get the Netflix special. Like, that's what you're doing, testing material and seeing what hits, which is why also you want to practice and pitch practice and get the feedback and so on. But that's what it is. And you have to adjust in real time.
Yeah.
Because you just need one.
Yeah, totally. You know what's so fascinating? You mentioned the stand-up comedy bit. It's something that I think about a lot. You know, every stand-up comic records their set.
Yeah.
And when they do crowd work, they see what lands. Yes, they see what 100%. Gets people. And then they go, well, okay, let me work that into a skit or story that I can put into my broader show.
Yeah.
And it surprises me, you know, coming from a banking and sales background myself, it surprises me how often people don't record themselves pitching. You know, and again, there's whatever laws around how much of the other side you can record,
sure.
but just record your end of the conversation. And how do you answer a question? Could I be more concise? Could I have nailed this point a little bit better? Should I have brought these aspects of my business to the forefront? Because at the 45-minute mark of a 60-minute mark, that's when the investor perked up and said, wait, you can do this? I haven't seen a single company that can do that.
Yep.
Forget about all the other stuff you talked to me for 45 minutes about. Now we're going to talk about
this. Right.
And if there's like tactical advice coming out of this conversation, record yourself more. I did that when we were pitching LPs.
Mm-hmm.
I recorded my side of the conversation. And, you know, again, I wouldn't remember exactly the question, but based on your answer, you know what you're answering. I created a doc called Objection Handling. And I would, every time an LP would give me an objection about us, our model, our fund size, our structure, whatever, I would remember my answer. I would transcribe it, and then I would get it tighter and tighter and tighter. And it's those iterations that you need to do ultimately.
100%.
If you're going to fundraise at that scale.
Well, that's exactly right. The feedback loops are long and often are, no thanks, I'm going to pass.
Yeah,
whether it's a fund
answers.
Or whether, exactly. And so you're actually not getting feedback on what it is that is not a fit.
Working,
and what's not working. And so you have to proactively go out and try and do what you said, get tighter, like even listening for yourself, like how did I think of that answer? What was that good? That was too rambly. Be tighter, use the tools at your disposal. And, you know, so in the founder context, like this person can sit in on the pitch and they can even just write it down. Hey, tighter, shorten, make better. And, you know,
people were nodding.
People
when you
were
said
nodding.
This.
Exactly.
Yeah,
like somebody's not watching you. They're watching the audience.
Yeah.
And that's important to document and, again, learn from because it's out there for you to use.
Yeah, yeah. I remember Wiley Cirelli, who was one of the earliest sales guys at Seamless.
Yeah.
You know, he would say, again, they record everybody's calls. But one of the things that he would always tell his sales guys is you get to make the pitch your own after you've done it my way. So do it correctly.
That's
do
right.
it this way. And then like any stand-up comic, you can have riffs. You can iterate. Yeah. You can go a little bit longer on a set if you feel like the audience is reacting longer. But that baseline pitch is kind of always home base. You always come back to it. Wow, we went off on a total tangent here. But I feel like, especially in this fundraising environment, the tighter you are, the better your answers are, the more you're going to stand out in the mind of investors like us who are meeting, like I said, hundreds of founders 100%. Every month.
And every investor is going to want to key off of something different.
Yeah.
And so one of the kind of analogies I've used is like you're touring your house and some people are going to care about the bathrooms. Some people are going to want to see the master. Some people want to understand the tiles and, oh, why is this light fixtures like this? You have to know your house and go deep on whatever it is that the investor is keying off of. And so you can't expect all the investors to care about the same things,
yeah.
Which is why if you can go deep and meet them where they are and what they're questioning, you only further serve to elevate yourself in their eyes because you have a just deep understanding of your own business across all of the vectors.
Yeah. How did that apply? Let's flip it a little bit to the LP fundraising side,
sure.
The fund manager fundraising side. How did that apply differently, or you know, what lessons did you take from that when you were going out and taking Garuda from a 3 million, you know, nights and weekends,
yeah,
passion
fund,
project,
totally.
Micro fund. I was going to call it passion fund.
Yeah,
but
passion
fund.
No, that's
good.
Too, passion fund.
And turned that into, you know, the $31 million institutional fund.
Yeah, look, it was not too dissimilar from the way I think about investing and fundraising for a company. Like, why are we doing this? And so, you know, we spent 6 months, Arpan and I, as co-founders and GPs now of this fund, of like, why do we want to build this fund? What are we trying to achieve? What are our goals? Where do we want to play in the market? And let's look at a fund model. How does the math work? Should we be a $31 million fund and invest, you know, 100 to 250K in a whole lot more companies? Do we want to be more concentrated, get more ownership? Do we want to, is it 15 and 20% ownership? So now you're even more concentrated with the constraints of the fund and so on. And so we tried to know our business because venture is a business. And to be able to thoughtfully and articulately speak about fund construction, your why you're doing this, what is your differentiation? How do you think about the sourcing, picking, winning, supporting, exiting of the fund, but also the operations of building the company and the fundraising side? You know, those are the swim lanes of venture. Being able to talk about all of those, it was a lot of practice and a lot of work. And I think, you know, there's whatever the Twitter debate about, is it harder to be a fund manager or a founder?
Oh, a founder.
Founder. Except for, I think, fundraising, because in a fund case, you can work a prospect for 18 months. They commit. Great. They're only going to be 10% of your fund.
Yeah.
And so you have to go do that a whole bunch more times. As compared to when you're raising for a company, you need one lead.
Yes.
And then everything comes together. But
yeah, I'll add one more reason. I think it can be harder as an emerging manager, especially your first fund, to go and fundraise. It feels so personal when somebody says no.
Totally.
Because you don't actually have a fund. You have your track record.
Yep,
you know,
that's
I had
right.
my launch capital deals.
Yep.
Obviously, they were doing well. My angel portfolio, fine. But they said no to your face.
So they said, oh, yeah. And right? You're not, they didn't like my idea. They didn't like the market that I was in. No.
There's no TAM analysis to do here.
100%. No, and I think as a fund manager and a founder of any kind, that's what you build. You build humility.
Yeah.
And you build a thicker skin. And it's a process of self-growth and evolution that I don't think can be spoken of enough.
Yeah.
Because the people the person you were when you started, the idea kicking around to then after the funder is a totally different person.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend to find too what it's helped me do more when I'm speaking to founders is look for signals of resilience.
Yeah.
Because now, you know, having worked at other funds before, fine, it was a job and I was building somebody else's portfolio. Doing it for myself now, having gone and fundraised for myself now, I understood really, like, you know, at a core level, how resilient you have to be. And I know I asked you this question earlier about, like, what do you look for more now? I look for those stories more, where I'm like, hey, tell me about a tough, you know, situation that you had.
That's right.
How you reacted. And you really learn, you know, ultimately, the job of a founder is to run into a brick wall every single day until some cracks start to show.
That's
and
right.
Then you can find a way forward. It's hard when you're doing 30, 60-minute Zoom meetings sometimes to really assess that with a founder.
No, absolutely. We always try and meet founders in person ahead of investing, only because.
How 2019 of you, by the way?
Like, don't get me wrong. Yes, but again, back to like why it was hard for me to think about going to another company and like doing it over Zoom. I think Zoom and virtual is great for first, second meetings, but I think there's such a difference being in the same room.
Yeah.
To the point where I took a red eye from California to New York to meet a founding team for three. We were basically there. But like, okay, let's just go meet.
Yeah.
Met for 3 hours, had a great lunch, just talked about the business, talked about life, what their goals are, and then said, yeah, we want to invest, and presented kind of our term sheet and reverse pitch deck.
Yeah.
And we won the opportunity to partner and beat out bigger firms, bigger names, we find out later, because of that willingness to A, go above and beyond, and B, also meet in person. And I think energies colliding in the real world is a very powerful thing.
Tell me about this reverse pitch deck. That's such a curious concept. What is that in, without going, you know, too super in depth, what does that entail?
Look, we think founders pitch us all the time.
Yeah.
And as an emerging fund, we have to be pragmatic about where we stand in terms of our awareness and like how well people know us. And so we try and tell founders very explicitly why you should partner with us and why you shouldn't. And so if you're looking for an established brand with a massive following and, you know, global recognition and all of that, that's not who we are. But we talk about, you know, you're part of our origin story. Every check for us at Garuda matters. There's no such thing as a flyer option check that we invest in. And we're here to be in it with you together and work side by side, help you go further, faster. And this is what you can expect from us. And we lay it out. It's like, you know, these are the post-investment deliverables. This is the cadence. This is what we do for our founders. And then we also have contact information and kind of quotes from our founders and like
references.
Whoever you want to talk to, talk to.
Yeah.
Because that's what's, and if you don't choose to partner with us, that's fine. But like, let's understand and set expectations up front and let us tell you why.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that, by the way. We did a lot of that for our LPs. And I feel like actually it makes a ton of sense to do it for founders. Even if you're not leading, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because
100%.
Founders, my philosophy of, I think, where venture is going in the next decade, founders are going to build their ideal cap table.
Yep.
And they're going to build it around who supports me on these things that I need, right?
That's
so one, it takes a founder who has the self-recognition to know, hey, I'm great at technical stuff. Maybe I don't have help on storytelling. Okay, I'm great at this. Maybe I don't have help on sales. I need to backfill with people around me on that. But as they're building that super team around them, they need to know and they need to reference you.
Yeah.
And it's still blows my mind how rarely founders reference their investors before they have them on.
100%.
It's crazy. It doesn't take that long, but it's a couple of phone calls, a couple of questions. It just doesn't happen.
I tell founders that I've partnered with who are raising capital from other investors for subsequent rounds or even for us, ask for 3 references. And sorry to all the investors that I'm going to piss off by saying this. Ask for an introduction to a founder where it's gone really well.
Yep.
Where it's gone okay.
Yep.
And where it hasn't worked out.
Yeah.
And get the introductions, but also see how long it takes for them to make those introductions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These are all little signals.
Yeah.
And not the firm.
The that lead, person.
The person.
Yeah.
And if they haven't, if they're new or to venture and what, fine. But just, you have to ask.
Yeah,
because when everything is up and to the right, and you know, or it's too early to tell, everything is good. Investors are in sell mode. I sell founders all the time, every day. I'm in sell mode. It's when shit hits the fan, or when something's not going exactly right. How do they respond? How do they react? That's when you, as a founder, will really care.
Yeah,
and for you not to have made the phone call because you're super excited. You got the offer. You wanted to raise money. Be done with
the vibes are high.
The vibes are high. Exactly. Like, we're all chilling. Like, it's like, just make the damn call.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Totally. Totally. What is something in building your fund you wish you had done sooner, or even as you were fundraising, you're like, man, I wish we had done this sooner?
Honestly, I wish I had built relationships with LPs sooner.
Okay.
The intention when we did the micro fund was not necessarily to turn it into a full-on fund.
Yeah.
And go full-time with Garuda. And so as a result, it was not a process of like, okay, we're doing this and now that's going to prove track record and let's just tell the story. So we started cold. And needing to get introductions to LPs who, unlike GPs, don't want to be found. And are not, you know,
not on a database, not on blogging.
Not blogging, not on Twitter, none of that. Not doing it. Now there are lots of great LP podcasts, but they weren't, you know, they're not on podcasts and the like.
Yeah.
And so being able to build relationships, because I view venture as an ecosystem, ultimately as a people and relationship business.
Yeah.
And if you have the relationships, your odds of success go up because people are now able to connect dots to draw lines and say, okay, I want to back this person. I want to work with this person. And so we had to do that from a cold start. And we had the amazing support of our existing LPs from the micro fund who came in for, I think, 2.8 times the amount that they had done in fund one, which is great. But it was a lot of first-time conversations and why you should partner with us during what happened to be a crazy market with the war in the Ukraine, interest rates going up, inflation, market collapse, then bank collapses in 20.
Because you were doing the bulk of your raise in 2022.
2022. We did a first close in January of 22 and we're deploying and raising at the same time.
Yeah.
And then did a final close in mid 23. And so it was not a short process.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my advice to anybody who asks me, okay, what do I need to be thinking about? I'm thinking about doing a fund. Okay, where are you at in your process? And wherever you can, just start to get to know how you want to construct your LP base and start to build those relationships. Because if you can start off with a couple of strong anchor types of commits from the types of LPs you want, you're just going to be catapulted further.
Do you find those folks actually want to meet? I hear this advice from other emerging managers a lot too. And I also hear that you're always fundraising, even when you're not fundraising, we get the same advice to founders, honestly. Do you find like people want to actually talk to you, these endowments and foundations or investors want to talk to you when you're not officially in market? You only deployed 40-ish percent of your current fund. They're like, okay, buddy, like we'll chat, but call me when there's something to do here.
In my experience, and again, I think it, you know, your mileage may vary depending upon the size of fund you're raising and the likes. Like if you're raising a sub $20 million fund, an endowment, it's too small.
Yeah.
And so you have to try and call out LPs for your fundraise as much as possible. And so just call out all day. But I do think, in my experience anyway, and limited as it is thus far, people want to meet because they also know it's a relationship game. And what is the thing that they can learn from this conversation is what I always go into conversations thinking about and wanting to deliver against. And so I think people are happy to meet. And frankly, if you're not actively raising, then there's no awkwardness pressure.
So
it's just a relationship development, and like you can be up and we're upfront about it. Like we are not actively raising for a fund right now. We are deploying. We're 40% through our deployment for this fund, and we, you know, probably go raise our next one sometime next year. We are not actively raising, but we're still, as you said, having conversations with LPs, both current and prospective, in order to demonstrate who we are, tell our story a little bit more, and give them the opportunity to connect the dots to make lines.
Yeah, yeah. I think it helps too. I tell founders this idea of like increasing your surface area,
yes,
right?
That's right.
And that's the way we think about PR and storytelling and content is you are increasing your surface area by which people can build a relationship with you. And I there's a quote I heard recently, which is like, organizations move at the speed of trust.
Yes.
Right?
That's
the
great.
The faster you get to trust,
yep,
the faster a buyer signs with you because they trust 100%. You, they trust your product. An employee on boards with you because they've built trust with, you know, Rishi seems like a great guy to work for. I've watched his appearances on XYZ podcast. Yeah. He's been on Climb before. He's got to know something.
That's right.
Right. There's those aspects where founders, I think, shy away from it. Those one-on-one conversations with a founder and a VC or a VC and an LP is, I think, increasing that surface area.
Yep.
And to I think, highlight the point you just made, if you're not doing that, then you're doing yourself a disservice for the time you actually need that surface area.
That's right.
Now you're in the process of building it.
100%.
Right? So 100%. It just takes longer.
I mean, very intimate. I know the value of just being out there. I have a Substack, a blog that I write.
Yeah.
And I got my job at Legion in part because of that, where our CEO, Sunish, she said, oh yeah, like let's just chat and see, because I don't need to talk to you about how you think because I know how you think.
Yes. Yes.
And that is so powerful because I've done the work already. And like you said, someone has built a relationship with me through my writing or my podcast, whatever it is I'm on. And so they have a sense of who I am already, which is incredibly powerful. And it's there's one-to-one, one-to-some, and one-to-many. And I think you have to be, as a founder, a fund manager, you have to be working across all of them, because like you said, it gives more people opportunities to get to know you without having you in front of them.
Yeah.
Which is not scalable.
Yeah, totally. So a couple of things we'll close on here. You know, we talked more about, I think, the process of building, which I love. I don't think we get to talk with folks who have the depth of operating experience that you do enough on the show. Talking about the kind of things you're investing in, you said, you know, AI and intelligence, climate 2.0. Forgive me, I forget the other two.
Fintech, security.
And security, right? As you look ahead to 2024, are there, or even beyond that, but are there nascent areas today that you're excited about that you think are going to be a much bigger deal in, let's say, 2030?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of the more things change, the more things stay the same.
Okay.
In a lot of ways, you know, people, I think about like the fintech of the category. Saw it super highs and then the come down.
Yeah, people are kind of off on
and
fintech.
People are kind of
right
off.
Yeah.
But the way I think about it, everyone's going to need to pay for stuff. Money's going to need to move around. People are going to need to transact and they want to do it better, faster, quicker. And so the movement of money and the underlying infrastructure, systems, tools, processes to make the both consumer and B2B buyer journey better, I don't think is ever going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
As more attack vectors open up because of the proliferation of AI and models and people, we're going to space now. And like, you're going to need to secure it all. You're going to need to protect it. You're going to need to not only be able to understand what's going on, but you're going to need to then be able to understand if there's a malicious actor that's trying to, you know, attack or has gotten in, and how do you solve for that? And so, you know, all of these amazing new technologies are coming out that are being launched, but I think the underlying infrastructure, security, movement of money, use of applications is going to be the same.
Yeah. So I guess on that note, when we take a market like that where it went through a high, it kind of cooled, truthfully, anecdotally, those valuations haven't cooled as much as one would have expected.
Sure.
And, you know, you and I were chatting a little bit before we got on the mic that when we started our venture careers, there were great kind of 2 million on 8 post kind of rounds, founders with real founder market fit and traction, all this kind of stuff. And these days it feels like they don't exist. I'm seeing pre-seed founders raise at 12, 15 post with a deck and a dream.
Yeah.
Do founders need to adjust their expectations, or do we as VCs need to be looking at things differently? Like, when you have a market like that, like how do you find deals that make sense for yourself as a fund?
I think it's a bit of both. I think founders need to have investors have an open and candid conversation about what it means to raise at 12 to 15 versus raise at 6 to 8.
Yeah.
And we have that conversation with founders every day because the market has fundamentally shifted. I was talking to a friend of mine, seed investor, and he's like, look, the bar for a seed for us, $500,000 in revenue.
Wow.
And we're investing typically at a 12 to 15 pre for a seed.
Yeah.
$3 to $5 million round.
Yeah.
Okay. One data point, not to say that he's the only data, but like that's the bar for some seed investors. if I'm investing at pre-seed at those valuations,
there's no room to
grow. There's no room to grow. Or I'm not getting compensated for the risk that I'm taking.
Yeah.
And conversely, you as a founder now need to make a lot of progress relative to what somebody who maybe raised $1 million, $1.5 million at six has to in order to see the momentum and the next step. Yeah. And some founders say, oh, well, I'm willing to take that risk. Like, that's okay, because I think I'll be able to hit it. It's not about, you have to think more about than just you, but about the team. Your team has gotten in at a whatever entry price 4.9 evaluation. Their milestones for success are similar in the sense of, oh, we just raised new capital at an up round. Great. Momentum.
Yes.
If it's at a flat round, if it's at a down round, you can't control what people are going to think.
They start updating their resumes.
And they start updating their resumes. And now all of a sudden, you've gone slower because people are leaving. You have to backfill and so on, which is a tough place to be.
Yeah.
And so, you know, just some data point for us, average entry valuation for us, 8.2 post.
Okay.
And so the opportunities
are out there. Yeah.
And for us, we try to be disciplined in our approach. And again, in our conversation with founders, I have passed on price more times than I can count.
Yeah.
Where I talk to a founder, I don't think you're there. You're raising your first round of capital. I'm glad that the market is willing to give you 15 or 20, but it's not for me. And this is why. And, you know, I have founders come back, oh, I wish I had listened to you.
Mm.
And then I say, how do I get that message to more people? Because you don't believe in the moment.
Yes.
It's only after you've seen what happens
and at that
when
point,
it hasn't gone up into the right the whole way. And I think the market today is different than it, and so all of the fundraising lessons from 2020 to 2022 need to be forgotten.
Yeah.
That is not the market today.
Yeah.
And it's still, I think, has not been learned enough by founders and employees around, watch your burn. Don't overhire. We tell founders, great, I'm glad you raised $2 million. Take $500,000, put it away. Don't look at it. Run the business on less. And this pot of money is for when stuff starts to work, you can dip into it.
Yep.
Because at the very least, it's going to extend your runway beyond the timing that you thought. We just have to get scrappier. We have to build better businesses. We have to go back to basics and fundamentals.
Yeah, cut your wallet in half and see if you can run the business.
Absolutely.
On that.
Because if you're a pre-seed company and you're burning 80, 100K, what are you doing? And if you're only, but conversely, if you're burning 10 or 15K, did you need to raise it all?
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, trying to just give them data around metrics and numbers and what burn needs to look like and so on. Again, the benefit of having a portfolio and being able to see a bunch of companies and talking to other investors and what you need to do is important. You know, we talked about the reverse pitch deck.
Yeah.
One of the things we put in there is the risks we see to the business.
Yeah.
Because, and what we believe needs to get knocked down in order to see the milestones that you want. And assuming that you're not a one and done capital raise to profitability, what you're going to need to get to the next round. And we have that conversation.
Yeah.
Do you agree?
And it shows that you've put that level of depth of thought.
Absolutely.
Which hopefully is the reason that they picked
show,
you.
Show, don't tell.
Yeah.
All day. Show, don't tell, founders and funds.
Love that. Love the fourth wall break. We don't get that enough either. I'll close where we love to close with all of our guests. And you could take this in a myriad of directions. But talking about the market today, a lot of doom and gloom out there. You know, a lot of constraints at Series A and Series B. Rounds aren't growing quickly. Founders are... average time to raise is like 700 days for a Series B or something crazy like that, right? So with all the doom and gloom out there, what is something that keeps you hopeful as an early stage investor supporting your founders at this stage?
There's so much opportunity. I think it's hard to be an investor and not be optimistic, especially for at our stage, because this whole business is all about optimism and hope. There is no reason any of these companies should exist. There's definitely no justification for any of the, like, it's a deck and a dream. It's worth zero, right? But the market has given it value because we believe there's an opportunity for more value going forward. And I look back at history and all of the challenge times that, you know, going back to the Great Depression, the World Wars, even the Great Financial Crisis I graduated into. And I was a big banker at Merrill Lynch in 2008 during the crazy market cycles. And there's always positivity. There's always optimism. And it's through these times that great businesses are built. And so I view now as no different. Yeah. And that's why it gets back to just finding the people. What it does do is it washes out the tourists. And so anybody who wanted to be a founder for the wrong reason, oh, I'm going to do it because my friends are doing it. I think it's cool or whatnot. I think those people in moments like this time, uncertainty, stay where they are.
Yeah.
But the people who really want to go build, have a burning desire to change the way something is done because of an opinion that they formed through understanding a problem area or having deeply researched a category and now want to go solve that, that's always going to be there.
Yeah.
And you just have to find them.
Yeah.
And you have to trust them and help them and support them. And I love it. And I'm so grateful for the opportunity to do it. And so, you know, I can't not be optimistic.
That's awesome, man. That got me fired up. That is a great place to leave our conversation today. Rishi Taparia from Garuda Ventures.
Thank you so much
for joining me on the show, man. This was really great.
Hey, had a great conversation. Look forward to doing it again.
Would love that. Well, that's it for this week's episode of Climb by VSC. Thank you so much for watching and listening. My thanks to Rishi Taparia from Garuda for joining me on the show today, sharing his experience as an operator turned VC and all the lessons for founders from that. You can follow him on socials. We'll make sure we link those in the show notes as well. Hey, did you know that you can watch as well as listen to every episode of Climb? Find us on YouTube for full episodes and lots of clips that we post basically every day. And we'd love for you to follow us on social while you're at it. Lastly, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review, 5 stars only. And if you love this episode, recommend a guest to us. We'd love to have them on the show. Well, that's all for now. Thank you so much for watching Climb by VSC. We'll see you next week.